Rob Wolf, Andy D is back with episode 53, The Paleolithic Solution, without the intro music today.
Only today, though. We'll bring it back. Folks seem to like it. We'll provide some samples, and then hopefully we can gussy that thing up a little bit more.
And thank you very much, Jeff, for doing that, although I gave credit to the wrong person last time. But I get confused with the hundreds of emails coming through that sometimes my brain doesn't work very well.
I don't know how we thought that Jeff was Scobie one, but I don't know, man. We just barely keep this program on this train on the rails. So
it's amazing it shows up every Tuesday, frankly. So
it totally is. It totally is. Yeah. I am shocked.
So, Rob, recently, I believe you presented at NASA. I want to preface this by every time when someone asks me, like, where Rob was, I'm like, oh, he's at NASA. And they're like, you mean like NASA Space NASA? And I'm like, amazingly so. I don't know of any other NASA that I'm aware of.
Yeah, they have seriously lowered their standards on admission. So there's no height minimum for this ride. So, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what that was all about.
It was super cool. Erwan LaCour, MoveNat founder, and myself were invited to come out and speak at NASA at the Weil Laboratories at the Johnson Space Center, and basically kind of put our ideas about some strength and conditioning and nutrition ideas that could maybe improve their attempts at minimizing microgravity adaptations, which are basically like loss of muscle mass, loss of bone density, and some other related issues. And so we each did about a 45-minute presentation. Erwan's was mainly focusing on, you know, like phenotypic expression, normal phenotype of like our kind of hunter-gatherer ancestors and how we've deviated away from that and looking at sedentism and how that kind of models the microgravity environment. I covered a lot of that same material, got in and recommended some strength and conditioning recommendations and some nutrition and lifestyle recommendations, and it was super well received. The folks there were actually a little bit surprised by how up we were on the program that they were implementing, and it's kind of funny, like they were just in I wouldn't say a battle, but they were pushing recently to really do a study on like rate of force development type work on muscle detraining, because one of the main features is not only that astronauts lose cross-sectional diameter in the muscle belly, but they also lose innervation, so the ability to recruit the muscle powerfully and, more importantly, quickly. And so I had a number of protocols that I recommended for doing that. And it's kind of, you know, standard S&C type stuff, and they have some really knowledgeable people out there running the whole program. But sometimes there's this funny dynamic between, like, the exercise phys folks and the medicine folks and the exercise phys folks trying to put some more progressive type training into place and also some nutrition recommendations, and then getting some pushback from the medical scene there and the nutrition scene. But then they also have some wacky constraints on what they can do. Like we had a recommendation for a kind of a bungee cord apparatus to do some rate of force development and also some kind of shock absorption type things to maintain muscle mass and bone mineral density and all that. But you can't do something like that on the International Space Station, because the shock wave goes through the whole space station and it starts flapping the solar panels in such a way that the solar panels could snap, you know, and you're kind of like, oh, okay, I you know, you never really think about that. So there's this whole wacky interface of like medicine, exercise phys, engineering that all kind of comes together on this stuff. And a funny side deal is that there's a prominent Iron Garm guy who actually is one of the space setter scientists, and he absolutely hated my presentation. The dude is a total cookie monster, and he was writing on this extensively. He really liked Erwan's presentation. He's really into kind of a mind over matter kind of gig, but it's funny, the dude is a physicist and completely hated my presentation, particularly the nutrition side. So that's just a funny aside. I'm really hurt that he didn't introduce himself to me, but, you know, whatever. But it was cool. It was fun. It looks like we're going to participate in developing a bed rest study, and we're going to write a grant for that and, you know, look at doing some funding and do a research proposal on a paleo diet in a bed rest study, which is basically comparing, like, bone mineral loss, muscle loss, different metabolic changes with a standard astronaut diet versus a paleo diet. And this will be kind of interesting too, because all the anti-protein people who say that protein consumption causes bone mineral loss, this will be really interesting because we have great metrics on what all kinds of different diet parameters have been tested. And this is in this bed rest study, and this is possibly like the best scenario that you could see what in an isolated fashion different nutritional considerations result in what type of bone mineral loss or accretion. And so it'll be really interesting to see what a high protein, moderate to low carbohydrate, higher fat, a non-gut irritating paleo diet will do with regards to bone mineral loss or accretion. But that'll be something that we can, I'm suspecting that we'll see better outcomes. Maybe we won't, and then maybe we need to rethink our protein recommendations with regards to bone mineral density, or at least think about it in the context of like sedentary populations. But what we've seen thus far is higher protein intakes end up resulting in better bone mineral retention, despite the fact that it's a net acid load food. And like Matt Lalonde has talked a lot about the dodgy gray area of putting a net renal acid load forward as kind of the end all be all with a bone mineral retention. And so this will be a nice isolated way to look at some elements of that. So that'll be interesting. You were out on the road too, checking out some shenanigans. What were you up to?
Spent a weekend in Portland with Dallas and Lissa from the Whole Nine crew, and attended their one day, I'm going to call it their Whole 30 program, but if I screw that up, I apologize, and then also attended their half-day trainer workshop, and one, had a great experience with them because those people eat amazingly healthy and squeaky clean on the road. They picked me up from the airport, immediately went to Whole Foods, and I got to see the their kind of approach to living life on the road, which was actually pretty interesting and militant in a very positive and healthy way. Went to a really cool restaurant up there that I think it's called Laurelhurst, that is a butcher shop / restaurant. And all the, I would call it, vegan plus grass-fed beef. And so we actually ate there twice, had some wonderful bone marrow, steak tartare, excellent salads, and some great cuts of meat. So that was awesome. And then got a lot out of the seminar. The first one is sort of, I'd call it, so your seminar, Rob, I haven't been in a number of months, but it's pretty heavy on the paleo science in the beginning, and then you kind of talk about implementation stuff, and theirs is focused kind of from the beginning. They do a little sciencey for 45 minutes, and it's kind of like, for my mom and dad, this is sort of practical implementation, big picture, this is how we view the world.
Nice.
So I thought it was really well done, and there was a number of folks that were there that, you know, I wouldn't call fitness enthusiasts or kind of nutrition geeks, just kind of were trying to eat better. And I think Dallas and Melissa have a nice way of kind of saying, hey, let's just focus on eating real food, and then we'll kind of break that down and how that looks. And they have some nice concepts, how I think they mainstream that and get some good analogies, much like, you know, some of your sunburn insulin analogies that kind of make things pretty easy.
Cool.
And then day two, went to the trainer workshop, which I really enjoyed. And that's sort of their approach on how they review food logs, kind of their macro level view to the micro level view, and then also kind of the psychology of getting your clients to try things and some of the questions they use to kind of get that wedge about you know, how we get clients motivated. Because obviously we all know, you get someone in who buys in immediately and does everything you ask, that's like the easy client.
Right.
And the reality is like the psychology of some of this stuff is really the more important thing for some clients, because most people you get in aren't really interested in making wholesale food changes. And obviously we believe that the best results will come from wholesale food and lifestyle changes. So
I think massive amounts of anabolic steroids and amphetamines are actually the route to the most applicable and rapid changes. But unfortunately, my parole officer doesn't like that approach. So, yeah.
Oh, and soccer moms don't like that approach.
Yeah, soccer moms don't like that approach either. The mustache that they get out of it is very unsettling. No, that's cool. Dallas and Melissa do an outstanding job. I know they're doing a little bit of stuff with Dutch Lowy also. So that's cool that those hooligans are out on the road beating the smart eating paleo, smart paleo drum and all that jive. They do a great job. So if folks get a chance to check them out, they totally should. Also, Diane Sanfilippo, Balance Bites, she's out doing some stuff on a education format. And like all of these guys are largely tackling this on They have plenty of scientific steeping, all of these dudes do, but they're getting in and really hammering the practical implementation, like how do you feed and water yourself on a day-to-day basis, which is really where the rubber hits the road with all this stuff. And I tell folks in my seminar, if we just focused on how to, then the seminar day could collapse down to probably about two and a half hours, and we could do a great treatment of fat loss, muscle gain, optimizing athletic performance, special populations, ketogenic diets. But then, you know, it doesn't answer a lot of the whys, but not everybody needs all the whys. So it's nice that we now have some good offerings out there so that we can give folks a variety of options. So that's cool.
Yeah, and I think it's nice to have slightly different perspectives too. I think it's helpful for different folks. I think it connects to different people, you know, like Dallas and Melissa's pitch, and I think Diane's a little bit too, is, you know, they're focusing on health first and all those other things, body comp things, are kind of underlying goals related to that, which appeals, I think, to like my mom and dad, for example, or doesn't appeal to an athletic crowd necessarily. And I, you know, it's just like some of the Rip versus, who knows, Michael Rutherford, you know, I think different pitches sometimes appeal to different personalities. So I think it's important to have those kind of slightly different perspectives on things.
Totally. Totally. Well, cool.
Cool, man. So we're 11 minutes in. Also, I want to give a quick shout out to Scotty Hagness and his lovely wife, Rochelle, and the folks at CrossFit Fort Vancouver, who I got to hang out with. Hadn't seen them in a while since the gymnastics body seminar about a year ago. So always good to see all those folks.
Totally.
All right, Rob, questions. We're 11:34 in, man. We can ramble.
Dude, we can do this. We can make it happen. We can make it happen.
All right. So I want to tell everyone, too, I'm trying to catch up on blog questions, and we're starting with some of the more recent ones and work backwards in order to make things more timely-er. That's not even a word. So I'm going to do my best, Rob. Here we go.
Sweet.
Number one, question from Dan. Great episode related to 52. Question about Nathan's question about leaning out. I, too, have probably been dealing with cortisol release issues. My head keeps telling me to work out 6 days a week for 20 to 30 minutes each time doing Tabata-type movements, even with kettlebells and burpees. This may be too much for a person like myself. When you say take it easier, can you lead me to a direction of this type of training I would need to follow to lean up a bit? Book has been ordered. Thanks.
You know, I was just talking with Matt Lalonde about this stuff yesterday, and the old Art Devaney template of lift, you know, a couple of full body workouts per week, a day maybe of sprints, and then, which they, let's say that's 3 days, three or maybe 4 days, you know, if we did like 2 days of sprints or something. And then the other day is just trying to be active, you know, just getting out and hiking, stomping, maybe hitting a heavy bag, but, you know, largely unstructured, not trying to burn yourself out, and really kind of staying out of that glycolytic pathway. And Andy, you might be able to comment on this from some of the OPT CCP stuff. It's when we're trying to reverse cortisol issues, and we're the main focus is kind of a health, longevity, body composition focus, you need some training. You know, you need some smart training, but you absolutely are not going to benefit maximally from a beat down every day, or even just you might be able to be a little stronger. You might be able to be a little bit more metabolically conditioned, but you're likely going to see a suboptimal body composition come out of that scene. Like, what, Andy, what do you think with regards to like the OPT stuff? Does that kind of jibe with that? Or
I think that's like 100% right on. I mean, I think for some of the folks, when I talked to him about, you know, my cortisol issues and stuff we talked about in his like program design seminar, he's like, for some of these folks, it's going to turn into, you know, the creatine phosphate or, you know, weightlifting protocols, you know, a couple days a week, maybe it's two, maybe it's three. And in the beginning, you may just pair that even with light walking, depending on how jacked up you are, and then kind of finding some metrics to measure over time to see, are we moving in the right direction? And if so, can we add a little bit more work, even a little bit more aerobic work, like you're talking about, some of the unstructured stuff. And the other thing I would direct folks to, if you look at OPT's blog, he has some interesting thoughts. You'll see how he programs even the glycolytic pathway and stuff, and you'll see things done very differently than like on CrossFit.com. There's a lot more repeats in there as opposed to, you know, some Helen-like tests all the time. And from talking to folks that have done that type of training, and it's kind of this classic like sprinter, we're going to do repeats with rest in between depending on, you know, what energy system we're hitting, folks tend to not be beat up as much and still seem to make really good progress, kind of counter to the pound it every day model that some of the CrossFit type folks we see deal with.
Yeah, and you know, I'll yank my own chain here a little bit and remind folks about the Power Bias article that I wrote back in like 2005 or something like that, that was talking about exactly this stuff, you know, like, could you tackle Helen in a way that was still beneficial, but you could actually tackle it in both a technical development format, but also in a way that you are only getting punctuated exposures into that glycolytic pathway. And it's, in a way, it's a restive period, because it's not that you know, 7 to 10 minute just absolute beatdown that is very, very taxing. But breaking it apart, taxing different elements of the ATP creatine phosphate, and then that aerobic capacity in a recovery format, has some really nice benefits. And then also you get to tackle it in segments, work on some technical issues and stuff like that. So it's a smart way to go with all that.
Yeah, and I'm going to paraphrase and not blame OPT exactly for this quote, but, you know, something I took away from some of my discussions with him, and, you know, I think you and I have talked a little bit about it, is in some S&C circles, we see some leanings towards, you know, if we were to train someone for a 5K, Rob, we would not have them run a 5K every day, right?
Correct.
That is not smart training. But because of the variation in some of the protocols that we see, some of the CrossFit-esque stuff, we're basically asking people to do that, but you don't see that because we're varying the work so much. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, because of the proposed randomization, you can't see that that's what we're actually asking people to do it, but we are asking them to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And it, this is just that difference, and James is very articulate on it, the difference between testing versus training and development. And, you know, when you get out and you do a Helen, then it's a test, but then you know, it behooves one to have lots of training that goes into ramping that thing up. And there's all kinds of sub-elements of this: avoiding rhabdo, avoiding overtraining, avoiding cortisol release, and also just fundamentally making people progress better and safer. So, wow, and we've devoted 10 minutes on that one. So we may not get through very many questions today.
Well, every time we get a question like that, we spit ourselves out, Rob. So someone wrote me an email and said that must mean that we actually have a lot to say.
Yeah, and, you know, it's some of the more important stuff, and I think really the more interesting stuff. So it's.
And then this is a reminder to Nathan, we're still waiting for an update as to where things are. So
yes.
Moving on, this one's easy, Rob. We were talking about this last night. Question from Adam: decaf coffee, go.
I like it. I've been reticent to pony up to this because I feel like I'm kind of pussified in this regard. But the Cave Girl Cafe ended up coming out with some caffeine-free espresso, or low caffeine. Really, it's none of this stuff is caffeine-free, but low caffeine espresso, decaffeinated espresso. So normally when I do my stovetop espresso maker, the big one, it ends up getting 6 big tablespoons of espresso blend coffee thrown in there. And so what I've been doing is 4 to 5 tablespoons of decaf, and then 1 or 2 tablespoons of standard coffee. And that's been turning out pretty well. And then if I'm out of the decaf, what I've been doing is just turning my espresso into an Americano, which is basically I do... say like an 8-ounce cup, I'll put 6 ounces of hot water in there and then 2 1-ounce shots of espresso out of my coffee maker. And that's been working good too. Like, it tastes really good. And I got to say, like, I was so beat to death coming off of the book tour and all that. I mean, really beat up from the lack of sleep, the time zone changes, going to Europe. I mean, everything was really fun. It was super cool. We succeeded. We got a lot of cool stuff done. And by the end of it, I was begging Nikki to just, like, do a mercy killing and, like, shoot me, because I was so beat up and despondent and, you know, out of sorts. Did my physicality totally plummeted? And I really think the overconsumption of coffee was a big, big factor in that, too. You know, it was just kicking something that was already down. So for me, my kind of recovery off of that big, very, like, go pace for, you know, 2 months, 3 months has been really curtailing my caffeine intake, and I feel way better. But I still like having something tasty to sip on and all that, so the decaf is a nice option.
I can't wait till we have to reprint the gluten is death, caffeine is life shirt in 3 years, and I'm just so worried about what that's going to say.
It's gluten. Yeah, I don't know. Gluten is death, and there's nothing really worth living for, so forget it all. Abandon all hope, so yeah.
And I'm also trying to massively curtail my caffeine intake, because since my caffeine-free challenge, I have massively spiked my caffeine intake, and it tends to just wreck my sleep, wreck my training. It does nothing good, probably because I can't limit it to one cup a day. So I'm experimenting with the decaf combo a la Rob Wolf. So we'll see how that goes. I may just have to eventually go no decaf, but we'll see. We'll see how my body responds.
Sweet.
All right, man. Question from Shane. Hi, Rob and Andy. Love the podcast. Love the book. I really like the info regarding seasonal allergies. I've been a longtime allergy sufferer since I was 10, 11 and received weekly allergy shots and normally take antihistamines April through August every year. I'm looking forward to this spring to see how eating paleo affects my allergies. My question is regarding weight loss. I've read many sources saying anything more than 1 to 2 pounds per week of weight loss is unhealthy. What do you say regarding that when you consider a sudden change from a standard American diet to strict paleo? Some background: started strict paleo following the 30-day meal plan and supplement recommendations in your book 9 days ago. 41, 128 kilogram before starting paleo. Been in good to athletic condition most of my life. Before the last 3 to 4 years, work in software development, so I'm stuck in a desk 8 to 12 hours per day, get 7 to 8.5 hours per sleep per night, and haven't started the exercise plan yet. Somehow, though, I managed to lose 8 kilograms in the first week of this plan. After reading the book, I'm sure I have an undiagnosed gluten intolerance. I've had mystery stomach aches as a child and a teenager, tonsil removed when I was 6, allergies started when I was 10, 11, gallbladder issues in my 20s and 30s, leading to a removal when I was 33, and testicular cancer when I was 29. Thanks again for the book. I feel I've taken the first steps on the road back to good health. Shane.
So kind of main question here is just related to like what's reasonable weight loss.
Yep.
So, you know, what was he here? He was 128 kilos, we'll call it 130 kilos, and then he lost about 8 kilos in a week.
Yep.
And you know, mainly water weight initially, but had a 10% fluid loss in a week if somebody was retaining a lot of fluid due to insulin, possibly some food allergy related stuff is not surprising. 128 pounds is a reasonably big person, so yep. I'm not surprised by that at all. I don't know that there's really any like standards on this stuff. The dietitians get all spun out about this jive and try to put these really solid standards on what you should or shouldn't lose and what's safe and reasonable. But I think if you're doing it right, fat loss and weight loss in general can be remarkably quick and pretty stunning and completely healthy too. I don't know that I would really freak out one way or the other with this stuff, especially when people are not starving. There's nothing like over the top about this jive. You know, they're totally healthy, especially if they're starting to work out and everything. So this all seems totally normal and reasonable. And we've seen similar stuff in the gym and had tons of folks report stuff like this, had doctors report stuff like this with their patients. So I don't see any problem with any of that.
Cool. Good question. All right, Rob, very excited about the next one. this is all the rage on the interweb. So actually had some funny discussions when I was in Portland about this. So question from John Michael. Hey, Rob, I'm not sure if you talked about this study yet, but supposedly fish oil ain't as good as it used to be. Curious what you think about the study covered here. And this is from the Healthy Skeptic. It's been all over Facebook. And the link is in there so folks can see it.
Yeah, you know, this is pretty interesting, and what the link kind of uncovers, what the Healthy Skeptic talks about, is that it so much of what we see as being beneficial with consumption of fish oil, particularly the decrease in triglycerides, might in fact be kind of a sensing mechanism in the liver, which there's a mechanism when the liver is getting ready to release VLDL particles into the bloodstream that can tell whether or not those VLDLs, very low density lipoproteins, these are basically fat protein packets that are sending fats out to the body to be used for fuel, to be used for substrates to build membranes, and to be used in different reactions and whatnot. And what the liver does is it kind of samples that VLDL to see if it's highly reactive, to see if it could be dangerous to the body, and if it is, then that VLDL gets scuttled. It basically gets broken down, doesn't get released into circulation. And so this is kind of a sneaky way in which triglycerides can appear to be reduced when one is consuming large amounts of fish oil or other polyunsaturated fats. So the take home from this thing, there was more information that was talking about, you know, like there appeared to be some very good health outcomes with short-term high-dose fish oil intake but then it becomes much more murky once we stretch out, you know, a year, 2 years, and stuff like that. Some interesting correlative stuff with rapid aging in the Inuit, you know, what this thing kind of brings me back around, it's really interesting, and this is where it's always kind of good to, you know, look at this whole paleo model as a reference point. But coming into all of this stuff originally, I entered with mainly the framework of a chemist and looking at different lipid metabolism scenarios. And I knew for a fact that the oxidative potential of saturated fats was virtually nil. Like, you can just stick saturated fats in a jar and stick it out, you know, in the sun, uncovered, and the stuff, it's hard as hell to make it go rancid. Like, it's very, very inert. And from a oxidative damage potential in the body, that's a really good thing. And then getting in and looking at this paleo diet stuff and, like, the, you know, the questioning of whether or not saturated fats were really good because we didn't see large amounts of them in the ancestral diet. Like, I have to admit that I kind of hung some of my better judgment up, thinking this through from a mechanistic standpoint, and kind of relied on the anecdotal observational elements of the, you know, the kind of overarching paleo diet concept, which was you don't see tons of saturated fat in the ancestral diet, and therefore it could potentially be bad. And what we're finding, and Matt Lalonde, I've got to give him mad props on this thing, he's been beating this drum again and again and again, is that we can't just rely on that observational element. Like, it's a great place to start, it's a great place to ask some questions from, find some kind of correlative stuff, but we've got to rely on the mechanisms to drive the boat. And when we're looking at fish oil, and I think that Kurt Harris kind of subscribes to this, it's have enough of these omega-3 and omega-6s to do the things that we want them to do, and then no more. And then we're really wanting some saturated fats, maybe some monounsaturated fats, because of the improved or reduction essentially in oxidative stress that we're talking about. For me, what this means in implementation, I still think people who are very overweight, people who have loads of inflammation, absolutely still benefit from high-dose fish oil. In my mind, and I may modify my stance down the road, but my understanding of all this stuff, I still think people who are inflamed and sick absolutely benefit from fish oil. But then the goal is to get them titrated off of these high-dose fish oil supplements very, very quickly. You know, a month, 2 months, 3 months at the outset. If people, and this is all contingent on people sleeping and eating a low-carb kind of paleo-type diet, so that we're reducing inflammation from, like, gut health and all these other things. And then really the need for that high-dose fish oil should decrease very, very quickly. And so this is some stuff where, like, you know, looking at the whole nine fish oil calculator, we need to do some revision on that and probably drop the base fish oil recommendation down to maybe, instead of 0.25 grams per 10 pounds of body weight, maybe 0.1 grams per 10 pounds of body weight. And, you know, for people who are eating grass-fed meat and all that, probably pulling it down to zero. You know, you don't really need to supplement at any significant amount with any frequency. So there's some stuff that we need to rethink on that, but I stand by my thought that as an intervention, short-term intervention, the high-dose fish oil is very, very good. And I think over time what we've discovered is that even if you're eating conventional meats, but you're generally keeping your intake of short-chain omega-6s very, very low, like minimizing your seed oils and high omega-6 nuts and seeds, that we should not need all that much fish oil. So hopefully that's clear. Hopefully that kind of encapsulates all that stuff. I'm thinking about a blog post on this topic too, but hopefully that helps stuff. Andy, does that tie in pretty well with what you've been seeing with this?
No, that's 100% true. It reminds me, when I saw the whole nine kids, the first question I asked them was, do you regret creating the Rob Wolf fish oil calculator?
Because Andy D's is good, if it nothing else, stirring shit. So,
well, they don't take it the same way you do, Rob. We had a very nice discussion. But very good question. And once again, I think this is just a reminder about, you know, counterpoints and things are good. A lot of good discussion came out of this link that went out, although some people tend to freak out about, you know, when something like that comes out. But I think that was well worth addressing on the podcast, and hopefully you won't get asked 75 times on Facebook now. What do you think about that study?
We'll see. Now I'll be asked 125 times. So.
Well, you'll be asked a different question about the same topic, but right. You know, we're just trying to move the boat forward, Rob. That's the goal.
And, you know, I'll just ring the Michael and Mary Eads bell on this, which is reserve the right to modify my opinion as, you know, information comes available, and you do the best you can to put the best information out there with what you've got. And then over the course of time, hopefully we get better and better information, better data, and we can make better recommendations to help folks. So, you know, because sometimes people get so persnickety because you know, it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you change your mind, then you're some sort of a turncoat who doesn't know what you're talking about. But then if you, then what you're left with from that perspective then is you dig in your heels and you never change your mind ever again. So it's kind of a funny scenario that folks can paint you into sometimes. But yeah, really interesting bit of work.
Yes. All right, Rob, I got a long comment that I'm going to read from Matt Lalonde. Based on your cooking, and there's a couple things in there, and then you can address it at the end. But since we talked about Matt, he wanted to clarify his take on advanced glycation end products. So
perfect.
Here we go. Comment from Matt. I just want to clarify Rob's comment on advanced glycation end products. For one, I do not boil any of my meat. I slow cook everything at low temperatures in a crock pot or the oven. Boiling meat does not appeal to me in any way. Now on to the AGEs. The medical and nutritional community have the bad habit of always looking towards exogenous sources when they identify something bad. In this case, it has been shown that AGEs within the body, as a result of insulin resistance and hyperglycemia, increases the rate of aging and the risk of diseases such as heart disease. The medical community then identifies as food sources of AGEs and recommends that we do not consume them. Interestingly, the consumption of foods containing AGEs has not been shown to be at all that problematic, maybe a little bit of arterial dysfunction, but even that study is questionable. The real problem is often endogenous production as opposed to exogenous sources. AGEs result when blood sugars are elevated. AGE formation is rampant when blood sugar levels reach 180 milligrams per deciliter or higher. But high blood sugar levels are the result of insulin resistance, which is a result of excess carbohydrate, specifically fructose consumption. AGEs are problematic when they result from excess blood sugar levels, not so much when they're consumed from food. That being said, it is wise to try to minimize AGE consumption, and slow cooking at low temperatures is one way to do that. Then we got a comment from another Matt on the blog. He said, yeah, but what's more paleo than burned rare meat? Seriously, we must have evolved some coping mechanisms for any nasty chemicals that result. Just read Catching Fire. The whole cooking thing has been going on for a long time, it seems. And Matt L. responded, Matt, just because our ancestors may have burned meat doesn't mean it's optimal. Tolerated probably, optimal no. Our ancestors often slow cooked meat with hot stones. Observation equals correlation, not causation. You then have to do some research to determine which technique is better. Slow cooking wins on this one. That being said, there are far worse things than grilled meat, and like I mentioned above, endogenous production of AGEs is far more problematic. It has been shown that only approximately 10% of ingested AGEs make their way into the bloodstream. Our digestive system does a good job of decomposing AGEs, and I suspect that number would be less than 10% for an individual with a healthy gut. That was a mouthful.
That was too mouthful. That was a Canadian chemist mouthful. Yeah, and I was trying to comment on that thing with my iPhone while I was actually in Houston, and I was trying to ping in there and just do a one liner that it was Matt Lalonde. He does not boil meat, but every once in a while my comments get lost with my iPhone. The WordPress app doesn't work all that great, but I think this is, you know, there's a website Beyond Vegetarianism, and there's a whole huge chunk of material there where people talk about like a nitrosamine formation with different cooking methods, and I think this generally, like Matt said, like the kind of take home from this is probably like burning your food to death is not the best thing in the world, but they're you know, it's also not the worst thing. The main deal that if people really want to be healthy is avoiding metabolic derangement, you know, and the inputs on that appear to be lectins that can affect both insulin sensitivity and leptin sensitivity. We have some gut irritation that leads into inflammation, which can compromise insulin sensitivity. And then abnormally high levels of carbohydrate, particularly fructose-containing carbohydrates. And then also, of course, the omega-3, omega-6 imbalance. So if we mind our store from those perspectives, then we're usually doing pretty good, and you can get away with a lot more other stuff.
And I just want to say that I thoroughly enjoy Matt's blog comments because they're strictly the facts by the book science.
He is the Joe Friday of nutritional biochemistry. Just the facts, please, ma'am.
So. You would have thrown in a few snarky little comments, but Matt was like, "Nope, this is how I see it. Here's the facts." So
right.
Anyway, thank you, Matt, for putting that on there. We really appreciate that, and I thought that was like some good discussion.
Totally.
All right, man, moving the train forward. Question from Ivan. Too much protein, ? I didn't want to throw this question for the podcast because this is just my second week of paleo. Well, I'm putting in the podcast because I think this is a common question we get. I'm wondering why I didn't get any of the symptoms of ketosis. In fact, how would I know I am ketosis? I mostly eat lean meat, so I'm wondering whether I eat too much protein. I do eat nuts, guac, shrimp, fish like salmon, and so probably I am at a 50-50 ratio of protein, fat, or slightly better. I also have a bad case of cortisol because I feel extremely drowsy during the day and fresh in the evening, and I've accumulated a lot of fat in the abdomen. I'm wondering whether the protein is broken down by the cortisol. Initially, I was extremely low on the carbs, but have lost quite a bit of muscle and fat, so I've started adding some carbs now. Any input on this rabbit malaise will be appreciated. Thanks.
This one's just all over the place. I'm really not too sure what to make of this whole thing. Usually, it's very, very hard to overeat protein because of the satiating effects, and if people carry any amount of muscle mass or fat mass, then it takes a while to get into that rabbit starvation state because you have to get down to a relatively low body fat level where our production of or inability to metabolize that protein intake above about 30 or 35% starts becoming a problem. So this is just odd. What's your thought on this, Andy Dees?
So one of the reasons we put this in, and we had a couple of big questions further on for me, is that I think there are some folks that, depending on what they're eating before, and then they switch to kind of a paleo diet, which tends to be lower carb-ish, we tend to see weird changes in energy and all that stuff, and I think my theme on that is, we need you to stick with it for the 30 days, kind of focus on eating the lean meats, the nuts, the veggies, the fruits, etc., and then kind of see where energy levels are, because we get some folks like, oh, I feel like crap week two, and I'm like, yeah, because we're kind of changing what your engine's running on and doing a bunch of stuff, and you're used to jacking up your blood sugar every few hours probably and giving yourself some energy. And so I'm always like, let's just be patient and kind of see where you are once you've kind of adjusted to the new fuel.
Yeah. And I guess some of what was throwing me on this is like symptoms of ketosis.
Yep.
It's just I don't know what those symptoms are. Is it like better energy? Like usually once people are in ketosis and they have great energy, better sleep, all that sort of stuff. So that's where we're definitely a little tripped up on this. But yeah, Ivan, get back to us after you've been at this for a month and let us know if you're still suffering non-symptoms.
Yeah, and you can get like a keto stick and measure that, but I guess from my perspective, being in or out of ketosis is not like a critical thing for most folks. I guess
yeah.
I don't spend a lot of time worrying about it, except in very specific situations.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Moving on to Danielle. Hi, Rob. Been following a strict paleo diet for almost 3 weeks after eating an almost paleo diet for a year. I'm going to insert the Rob ? I don't know what that means, but haven't seen any fat loss yet. Am I being silly to hope for some change so soon? Should I take a sledgehammer to my scale? I'm going to insert editor's note. Please throw your scale away.
Yes.
Moving on. I've been focusing on sleep, 8+ hours in a dark, pitch dark room, natural calm pre-bed, omega-3s, getting 7,800 milligrams total from 2 doses, food quality and variety. I have taken a 2-week break from CrossFit and weightlifting to fine-tune these habits and have brought them back in as of a few days ago and feeling better for it. My husband and I decided to embark on a paleo lifestyle because we believe in being our best selves and wanted more energy, although we had no obvious with like quotation marks side effects from the bit of bread, cottage cheese, or fake sugar we ate before. On paleo, I keep carbs very low on weekdays, having a half apple with my egg whites at breakfast, and otherwise just from non-starchy vegetables and a tablespoon of nut butter. Calories are about 1,300 to 1,400, including fish oil. I am 45, 5'4", and currently a love handily 150 pounds. On the weekends, however, I'll have one day of considerably higher carbs with more fruit at all meals, melon at breakfast, fresh coconut water post-workout, and berries on paleo pancakes. Does having a higher carb day seem like a good strategy? I certainly enjoy it. I have about 15 pounds of fat to lose to get to 15% body fat. I'm a former type 2 diabetic, self-cured, and apple-shaped with obvious lifelong cortisol issues. Am I being unreasonably impatient regarding fat loss? No chance I'll fall off the wagon, but it does make me wonder if I might be doing something wrong. Thanks, Rob. Love what you do so much. Come to Montreal.
Why is she eating egg whites?
Well, that is one of the reasons why I threw this in here. I think there's some interesting dimensions to talk about with this question.
Yeah, I'm still sniffing like a maybe like a fat aversion. Too much calorie counting, some fat aversion. There's some stuff here. Danielle's got some stuff going on, and it sounds like you've done good by reversing the type 2 diabetes, but I suspect that there's probably some money being left on the table by probably some underconsumption of fat and probably food in general. Yeah, and if she was doing some CrossFit plus O lifting before, maybe we've got a little bit of overtraining. She said that she's working on her sleep, but you know, I mean, this is where it's funny. We had a client, Andy and I were, or no, it was Sean and I were talking about this just like 2 hours ago. I have a client who's super frustrated. Like, I just don't know. I'm doing everything right. And, you know, everybody wants to be like this unique snowflake where is it just me? Is it just not happening? Is it just not going to work for me? And then we get in and really dig around and look, and it's like, oh, okay, then the sleep really isn't nearly as good as what was claimed. We're too deficient in calories. We're too deficient in fat. The carb benders that we are doing are maybe too big of benders, and then it's just in the background of a lot of other problematic stuff. Like if we just had the person eat a few more calories, a little bit more fat, and sleep, that the leaning out process would go, and that's really all you need to worry about. So those are kind of some wacky things that stick out here. And again, without seeing exact meal plan, without being able to lay eyeballs on this person, it's a little bit challenging. But obviously, you know, like when Andy was reading through this, there were some things that were like, okay, there's some squirrely stuff here. And it definitely seems a little squirrely. Any other thoughts on that?
I mean, the first thing that jumps out at me is just, you know, you weigh 150 pounds, you're not eating very much. Like, to your point, I hate calorie counting and the idea, but sometimes there's some nice metrics maybe to throw around, and like 1,300 to 1,400 calories, including fish oil, is just not a lot of fuel for someone that weighs 150 pounds, in my opinion. And especially if you're doing, it seems like what it would seem, a fair amount of exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally agree. Like, when I see things like egg whites, I get worried about, you know, what we're doing with our fat consumption, and you know,
yeah, what are you up to with that? Why are you eating egg whites, kid? Yeah, that just cracks open a whole can of worms. So
so fat is fuel is what I always say. So let us know what's going on, Danielle. Good question.
Yeah, and so for prescriptive stuff, I would recommend eating whole eggs and eating a little more fat, and really making sure that the sleep is legitimately more on that 8 to 9 hour side, not the 7 to 8 hour side. And, you know, give some thought to how many days a week are you doing a burner in the gym and all that sort of jive. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think especially with someone that's like, hey, I know I have lifelong cortisol issues, you know, you really owe it to yourself to pay really close attention to how your training is impacting everything else. We've worked with some folks that are kind of using training to jack up cortisol to help with their energy, which seems like, I guess, like a good idea in the short term. It's obviously not in the short term and not in the long term.
Yeah.
And it seems like folks we deal with, especially at our gym, once they get to the point where they have some cortisol stuff, it's so easy for them to slide back into it that they really have to be like, monitored and talked to over and over about this stuff, because you can quickly see them kind of go from the good side of the suck line to the bad side of the suck line.
Yeah, and it's just I think it's just a sign of our kind of type A lives where we don't have enough downtime, just a whole slew of factors, you know, lack of sleep, lack of downtime, too much intensity in the training. And here again, like, if you want to be an Olympic athlete, cool, that's one thing. But if you're doing this to look good naked, then sometimes less is more.
Or, as I say, to make your life better, which yes. may include looking good naked, Rob, but not for everyone.
It helps me.
You're a unique flower, Rob.
I try.
All right, Rob, next we got a question from another handle. I like this one. This is from Canadian Arctic Paleo. It says, hey, Rob and Andy, I have a question. Obviously, thank you for sending that in. He says, I tried to phone into the radio show tonight, but Canadian residents were restricted from using the number provided. You owe me, big smiley face. Since moving out of my parents' home and getting my own place, dropping the carbs and the dairy has been the easy part. Being a coffee bean aficionado, I am finding it so hard to get the same Java experience I used to when I was drinking it with milk. I know coffee is okay while eating paleo. But put question marks next to that 5 years from now. Yeah. But I'm wondering if there is any product out there that I can add to my coffee that mimics the consistency of a nice cafe con leche. Please, I need coffee to live. Let's start there, and then we'll go to the next part.
This is kind of a hard one. Like, I think that there were some homogenized coconut products out there. I think Matt Lalonde shipped me some of these. I forget if it was the coconut yogurt or if it was like the coconut cream, but it was kind of like a coffee alternative. The problem with coconut milk is that it's not homogenized, and so the fat globules, you like pour it in and mix it up and it looks pretty good and you sip it and it's not bad, and then when you come back to the cup 5 minutes later, all of the fat is in a congealed layer on the surface, and so you have to keep constantly stirring it up. So homogenizing that stuff might help, but then the people who hate homogenized fat saying that your body can't absorb it, I don't know what we'd do in that case then. But that's kind of my only thought with this. I don't know what else to do. You know, the whole whipping cream is an option if you want to give that a shot. I do notice that stuff kind of irritates me though. It's kind of weird.
That is like the worst recommendation for me, because every time I try it, I get so much more mucus and saliva in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The whipping cream just jacks me up. I think I'm going to throw this quote on Facebook. I know coffee is okay while eating paleo. I'm just going to put a bunch of question marks next to that. I'm going to blame you, Rob, for that.
Cool. I'll take that bullet.
Additionally, I've been eating paleo for 3 months now. My asthma has improved exponentially. I'm fully off one of my puffers. I no longer take two puffs twice daily of my Flovent HVA. Have you heard from any paleo outlaws having their asthma improved?
Yeah, I mean, tons of people. All kinds of like upper respiratory stuff, breathing stuff tends to improve. Yeah.
Yep. Right on. Excellent handle, by the way. And
yeah.
I like the paleo outlaws. Next, I got a question from Brendan. Hey, guys, been a supporter of the paleo diet for a while now, but I just started listening to your podcast a few weeks ago and love it. Keep up the great work. My question is about the Mediterranean diet. I'm studying here in Florence, Italy for the fall semester, and I've been trying to pay attention to what the locals eat. I know the people in this region have some of the highest life expectancies of any people on the planet, but their diet is about as far from paleo as you can get. You were here recently, so I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. I've eaten my fair share of bread and pasta since I've been here, but it just makes me feel bloated and tired. Also, the people don't look healthy. They typically don't work out and definitely don't lift weights, and as a result, many of them look skinny fat. So what's the deal? Why do these people live so long, and what are your thoughts on the diet here?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is you can I did a ton of Road Forager blog posts YouTube deals, which I'm getting ready to start rolling those out. You can easily navigate a very paleo-esque diet in that scene. Now, folks do eat a fair amount of bread. They tend to eat more and more pasta as you go further and further north. And, you know, the interesting thing in that Florence area, the like regional dish of choice is a kilogram or larger T-bone steak. And you know, you have all the antipastis, which have like salamis and buffalo mozzarella. And we were just talking about like the whole whipping cream and causing like some, you know, nasal problems and all that. I ate a fair amount of cheese and had a fair amount of cream while I was over there, and I had like no joint problems, no nasally issues at all. Like the, I don't know if all the dairy is grass fed. I don't know if it's like a A2 versus an A1 cattle. I don't know, but I know that in general the food quality is much, much better. Like organic is kind of the standard. They have like six different tiers of organic and all this stuff. So in general, the food quality is much, much better. And, you know, this is still just one of those things where, so the people there have reasonably long lives. They walk everywhere. They have huge social connections and all that sort of stuff. And the social connections, there was just, I think the cover of Time or something like that showed that your blood lipid profile had no bearing on your longevity relative to how extensive your social connections were. Which this shouldn't surprise us a whole lot anyway, because it just gets ever more suspicious what if any factor cholesterol, you know, I think there's some inflammatory markers, C-reactive protein, and some different things like that are definitely highly correlative, possibly causative in some of the atherogenic progression and potential for like a heart attack or stroke. But you know, a big social connection, big social network, family, friends, all that sort of stuff, having a place where you belong, it is understood to be as important on your health as like a 3-pack-a-day smoker. So there's huge questions that need to be considered with all that stuff. So I'm not sure what more to comment on than that. You know, there are long-lived people who eat a wide variety of diets. There are high-carb, low-fat, high-fat, low-carb, grain eaters, non-grain eaters. I think one of the commonalities is that the grain eaters tend to not be these gluten-containing ones. We see some corn, we see some rice consumers, we see the Okinawans that I think eat damn close to what I would see as kind of a model paleo-type diet, which is like seafood and pork and fruits and tubers, and looks a whole heck of a lot like the Katavan diet, actually more protein than what we see with the Katavans. So I don't know, but then within all that, there was just recently a paper released on average hunter-gatherer life expectancy, and it's interesting. I'm going to do a blog post on that, but the kind of take-home from that was that the hunter-gatherers tended to live on average longer than what is generally ascribed to them, but then the end stage, once we hit year 70 to 80, is pretty rough. And I think that that's where like some really good health interventions, some smart nutrition over the long haul, you know, say like we were talking earlier today, probably a little more saturated fat versus polyunsaturated fat, and minimizing some of the advanced reactive oxygen species that are spun out with that. Keeping a generally low-ish blood sugar level, which will minimize advanced glycation end products. These are the things that really add up into like bridging that gap from the seventh decade to like the ninth decade or something. And it starts being those really deciding factors into the outer edges of average human longevity. But good, interesting question. But there's a lot of factors to it, you know, a nutrition and lifestyle being only... or nutrition being only a piece of it, you know, all the socialization and other things being hugely important.
Yep. All right. Next, I got a question from Lillian. My dad is in the last stages of Alzheimer's. He's in a nursing home. Is it possible the paleo solution will benefit him? Can it help reverse Alzheimer's? Please respond. Thanks.
Yeah, it's so, you know, we've seen this benefit people in earlier stages. The problem with the nursing home scenario is it's highly unlikely that you're going to get buy-in from the nursing home to modify his food in this direction. I mean, it any degree that you can reduce inflammation, reduce that metabolic arrangement that is typical of Alzheimer's, I think would help. But depending on how far the disease progression is, it's just really hard to tell. I mean, it's a heartbreaking situation. My guess is that it would probably help. Would it be able to fully reverse it? I have no idea. It's just really hard to tell.
Right. And I think this is where we always come back to, as you just said, like decreasing inflammation, generally a good thing for most people. Eating, you know, less dairy, grains, legumes generally helps people be healthier, irrespective of what they got going on.
Right, right. So from that perspective, yeah, it would help. But then, you know, where is he in his course with this? It's just tough to tell, really tough to tell.
Yep. Good. Next, I have a question for Paul. It says, Andy, thank you for all that you do. I'm sure the podcasts are not as simple as you seem to make them.
No, they're even more simple. We just screw them up all the time.
That's right. We're really good at making things look harder than they are.
Yeah.
Rob, love the book and your seminar down here in Houston. I attended Irwin's MoveNat clinic the day before your seminar. I was wondering how you intend to incorporate his methods into your training program.
Oh, man, this has been kind of a long-standing deal where I'm not 100% sure how to integrate the MoveNat methodology into our curriculum. I think given the fact that our gym has been so much in this kind of CrossFit-esque orientation, I think that opening up a second class, you know, just an alternate class and just call it MoveNat, and we just tackle everything in kind of a different way, I think would be a smart way to do it. And it would be just like an Olympic lifting class or powerlifting class or like a tumbling and athletics type deal. So that seems like a really smart way for where we are to integrate it. Andy and I were talking about this earlier, like there's all kinds of stuff that Andy's been playing with, like increasing the amount of unilateral work that are done, like the one-legged foot elevated, one-legged squats and stuff like that. And, you know, all of this stuff is legit. It's really cool to play with it and try to figure out how to integrate it. But our clients really become creatures of habit too. And, you know, sometimes unleashing too much change on them can kind of freak them out. So you're thinking about both efficacy and also keeping folks happy. But I think that people would really like everything that is involved in the MoveNat curriculum. And I think the de-emphasis on competition and the real focus on legitimately functional movement, you know, being able to crawl on, around, through various structures, the combatives element, like it's a really, really slick presentation of a situationally appropriate movement. And I think it's totally, totally legit, really awesome stuff.
Yeah, and I guess my only question about, and this is just, I think, that all the businesses struggle with, as you add more classes that offer more variety, I think within you have to come up with systems with how to monitor how heavy some of your users are. Because I know even with just the O-lifting class, you have some personality types that we have to kick out of the gym. Like, hey, you cannot take three classes in a day and have long-term success.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's a whole wacky deal. You know, like you crack open an unlimited class schedule and, you know, like what we have, you have like a 2 day a week, 3 day a week or unlimited. And the unlimited is with the understanding that most people are going to like a O-lifting gig at least a couple of days a week. And then we have some of our police or firefighters that will show up and do an elements class, an O-lifting class, and then a level two class. One after the other after the other. And you're just like, are you kidding me? Did you, you know, but yeah, it's funny, you know, it's a constant battle of trying to keep the clients happy, keep them moving forward, because obviously you got to keep the lights on and the bills paid and actually, you know, keep the trainers happy and you know, paid. But then at the same time, trying to do it in a way that our clients are actually with us 4 or 5 years down the road and that we're not just burning through people in a year and a half. So it's a funny interaction with that.
One more thing from Paul. I don't know if you are auditioning new catchphrases to replace Holy Cats. I seem to remember Andy mentioning that in a previous podcast, but let me nominate Holy Scat. Sounds a lot better than Holy Shite with the same meaning and is an anagram for Holy Cats. What's even more sad than my suggestion is the fact that it came to me in a dream the night before your seminar. Holy Scat indeed.
Well...
yes.
Scat-tastic. I don't know.
We appreciate the input, Paul. We will take it into consideration.
Yeah, we will run that through our bioethics committee.
Next, we got a question from Mikkel. Dear Rob and Andy, thanks for all the work you're doing. It's been awesome listening to the podcast. Enough questions about what goes in, so here's one about what comes out. I eat paleo for 10 months now. When I occasionally do a carb binge, then I notice that my urine changes smell, just like it can change smell if I've been drinking a lot of coffee. How come carbs change the smell, and what does that mean? Keep up the good work. Best regards from Denmark.
Probably seeing a pretty significant spike in blood sugar level and probably maybe even a little bit of spillover of glucose into the urine. And this is one of those things that Matt LaLonde and I have talked about this. If you're generally doing a low-carb diet, probably the best time to sneak in a good whack of carbs would be immediately post-workout. And it, because of the low-carb diet, we have some transient and appropriate insulin resistance because we're trying to allocate scarce glucose for the brain and for the tissues that run on glucose. But then what that means is that a lot of these other tissues are running on lipids or ketone bodies, and that's fine. That's totally fine. That's totally normal. But if you then whack the body with a big dose of carbs, it's going to react to it in an insulin-resistant manner. And so I'm guessing that this could be what's going on, is that you're getting a little bit of that spillover due to being relatively low carb. So like I would, if you're going to do kind of a carb bender, I would just time it post, you know, have some sort of a significant workout on the front end of that, or interestingly, start titrating up your carbs a little bit for a couple of days prior to the bigger carb eating, and then you should start. But what you're doing is shifting more of your metabolism towards carbohydrate based, you know, metabolic functions.
This question totally reminds me of something that just was cracking me up this morning, which is you know, Paul Check, who I love but is probably crazy, wrote a blog post today titled "The Joy of Pooping," which is a poem about pooping.
Check is a wild dude, man. Yeah, that's all I'll say with that. Check is a wild dude, but I dig most of his stuff.
There's actually a hilarious little picture, Rob. I'm going to send you the link to this because I was nice. Just like, I was like, my lord, jump the shark. Anyway, last comment, Rob, comes from Dallas from Hole 9, and we had a couple people chime in as well after episode 52, your talk about breastfeeding options. But basically he said, you know, there are certified human milk banks that, in his opinion, are much better options than going raw sheep goat milk for moms that can't breastfeed. It sounds a little weird at first, but the idea of a wet nurse has been widely used and accepted in many cultures for a long time, and it probably makes more sense than feeding our babies breast milk from another species. Maybe expensive or inconvenient, but given how significant the impact breast milk has on an infant's short and long-term health, I'd say it's worth the effort. Here are a couple links that you might want to share, so we'll throw those in the notes.
Yeah, that's some legit stuff. I suspect we'll probably see more stuff like this developing in the future. I mean, it totally makes sense. So it's just a matter of like having some good screening to make sure about the health of the individuals donating and all that sort of stuff, not dissimilar to a blood bank, and then you're kind of off and running. So
I like it. And with that, Rob, hour 2 minutes, episode 53, in the year 2 of the Paleo Solution.
Dude, we pulled it back on schedule despite our 10-minute introduction.
That's right. And soon we'll be back with the updated intro, hopefully.
Perfect. Cool.
All right. Thank you, and I'll talk to you next week.
Awesome, Andy. Thanks.
All right. See you, Rob.
Bye.